I like that gesture.
All right, good afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is March 22nd, 2017, and colleagues, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5536, the budget bill for the Secretary of State. Mr. Secretary of State, come on up. Welcome. If you just introduce yourself for the record, then we're just going to turn this over to you and let you run with it for the next hour and a half.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, Senate President. I'm Dennis Richardson, Oregon Secretary of State. It's a pleasure meeting with you again. I'd like to begin with a brief report on the question that was asked yesterday about receivables for the Secretary of State's office. There was a substantial increase in what was reported over last year, and the basis for that increase was previously only general fund debt or fines or fees that were owed to the Secretary of State's office were reported, but for some reason last year they decided to add in all other funds as well, and those are including assessments and so forth. And so at the end of 2016 there was a total debt of $345,000, $205,000 of which was this other funds addition. That presently is $4,877 because they're assessments and they've been paid on time or late, but they're paid now. And then of the other fund, the general fund that was owed, we still have about $139,000 that is still owed. Most of that relates to one fine that was assessed about 11 years ago against a legislator who left very suddenly his position here in the legislature. So, are there any questions about the debt?
Representative? Thank you very much for your follow-up, Secretary Richardson. So, I'm just trying to, I think you mentioned this, but I just want to make sure I understand. So, of the debt that we're currently carrying, what portion of that would come from elections versus coming from Corporations Division? I don't suspect that that Archives has a lot of delinquent debt. So,
no. Well, Archives has some, $20 here, $25 here, or there are some municipalities that pay in on an assessed basis. The vast majority of it, $116,000 of the $139,000, is a remainder of a penalty that was assessed to a legislator back in, I think, 2005.
That's the one account.
That's at one account, yeah.
$116,000.
Right.
Okay.
But he is making $150 a month payments. So it's like an annuity to the state.
So on the state's 412th birthday, we'll be caught up with him.
Yeah. I'm checking right now to see whether or not that remains. I mean, I haven't done debt work in a long time, but there were certain requirements for refiling or securing a debt or otherwise, maybe it's a penalty.
Mr. Chairman, so
maybe
he gets a $100 tax credit for contributing to his committee that pays the Secretary of State $150 a year. This is coming into focus for me.
All right.
Unique situation.
Thank you.
So with that clarification, I'd like to go ahead and invite up both Mary Winger and Will Garber, who are kind of the current heads of our audits division. Mary is the interim director, and Will is working closely with her. And if it'd be okay with you, because of limitations of space, I'll step back and let them take over for this portion.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So welcome. If you could just introduce yourself for the record, and then we'll let you.
Okay. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Winger, and I am the interim director of the Audits Division. Okay, for our budget, we rely on about $21.8 million in other funds for 74 positions. This amount comes from our assessments and direct bill charges to state agencies. The Audits Division bills agencies with constitutionally dedicated funds directly for actual audit costs. The remaining agencies are assessed quarterly for costs that are allocated based on a calculation that considers expenditures, revenues, cash, and FTE. We monitor our budget throughout the biennium, and if we determine we don't need all the assessment revenue that we collect, we reduce the assessment amounts for the remainder of the biennium. The goals for the division are to improve Oregon government programs and services and to improve the transparency of government practices so Oregonians can hold leaders accountable. We carry out these goals through the audits we conduct. As required by federal government and our state statutes, we conduct our audits in accordance with government auditing standards, which are developed and updated by the United States Government Accountability Office, the GAO. Those standards are critical as they provide an assurance to the public that our audits are conducted independently and objectively using professional judgment and due care by highly competent staff, and that our work goes through a very thorough quality control review process. Government auditing standards also require an external peer review every 3 years to determine whether an audit organization's system of quality control ensures compliance with professional auditing standards. The Audits Division has a contract with the National Association of State Auditors to perform this review. The most recent review was conducted last May in 2016 and was performed by a team of auditors from other states. The team concluded that our quality control was suitably designed and applied, providing reasonable assurance that our audits conform with government auditing standards. The Audits Division has successfully undergone these peer reviews for the last 25 years. Our professional workforce consists of financial, performance, and IT auditors. We have an outreach program which includes visiting various colleges and attending various career fairs to share what we do. In addition to bachelor's degrees, many of our staff have master's degrees. Our financial staff mainly have accounting degrees. For performance auditors, we look for people with master's in public administration or essentially any degree related to public service. These degrees include degrees in education, social sciences, computer science, environmental studies, and public policy. Our staff also includes IT auditors who typically either have a degree in computer science or management information systems or business admin with several college courses in IT-related classes. Staff have various certifications. We currently have 16 CPAs on staff. We have 5 CISAs, which are staff that are certified information systems auditors. Also, one of our IT auditors has a CISSP certification, which is a certified information systems security professional. To comply with auditing standards, all audit staff are required to have 80 hours of continuing professional education every 2 years. To meet this requirement, staff attend various in-house and external training, and it's related to either enhancing their ability to audit and improving their skills to carry out the audits. When conducting our audits, we use automated software for our working papers and sophisticated data analytics software. Our goal is to ensure our staff stay current on the latest software, so we encourage and we try to provide various training opportunities, including training with other audit organizations such as the Pacific Northwest Intergovernmental Audit Forum. And last week that took place in Seattle, and we had 4 people attend. Yesterday, the Secretary mentioned the challenge that we face in maintaining a workforce at full capacity. This has been the norm since I have been with the division since 1990, and for the most part, the turnover has been at a healthy level. Staff gain tremendous skills at the Audits Division and generally for opportunities to work in government agencies as internal auditors or in an audit capacity for a city or a county. On the flip side, we have also hired several auditors over the years from the private sector. We have implemented various strategies over the years to retain a healthy, maturing workforce. In addition to the intellectual challenges of auditing, we offer a variety of training opportunities, flexible schedules, and telework opportunities, which has been very much appreciated by our Portland commuters. We have several folks that commute to Salem. I would like to walk through the different audit sections. Of our 33 financial FTE, about 30 or 42% of the division's resources spend most of their time auditing the state of Oregon's financial statements and auditing several federal programs every year in order for the Oregon to annually receive more than $11 billion in federal funds. For fiscal year 16, the financial staff conducted statewide audit procedures at 24 state agencies. They audited over 500 different accounts, which represented about $25 billion in revenues and expenditures, $27 billion in assets, and $15 billion in liabilities. In addition, they audited 12 federal programs and followed up on the prior year findings for 7 other federal programs. Financial staff follow the GAO government auditing standards, which incorporate by reference the AICPA, it's the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, statement on auditing standards. They follow standards to determine which accounts to audit and what to audit for each account. They conduct risk assessments, they review internal controls, test account balances. Several audits entail using data analysis software at several accounts may involve thousands, if not millions, of transactions. They're looking to see if the amounts reported by the state are complete, accurate, adequately supported by sufficient records, properly recorded in the accounting system and in compliance with applicable laws and contracts. We have 27 staff who conduct performance audits, representing about 38% of our resources. These audits include reviewing management practices and agencies. From our perspective, we look at what is in statute as the expectations for the agencies. We are reviewing to see how well the agencies are achieving those expectations, and we look at ways that the agencies can do better. We're looking at bottlenecks, inefficiencies, and ways for agencies to be more effective at achieving the desired goals and mission of the agency. Ultimately, that is what affects citizens most, and if we can figure out how the public can get better services at less cost, then we are able to serve more people and get greater results. We focus on where agencies serve and interact with the public, and we try to figure out ways to stretch those dollars. We also focus on best practices for state agencies when conducting performance audits. We review applicable best practices and ideas in both government and, when applicable, the private sector from around the country that really work and that Oregon could implement to achieve similar results. For selecting audit topics, we try to assess what risks are in the state and where the dollars go and put our resources toward those efforts. We prepare an annual audit schedule in consultation with the secretary with the goal of using audit resources efficiently and strategically. We currently are budgeted for 7 IT staff, representing 8% of our resources. We audit information technology systems, looking at application controls and security. Those audits include auditing IT systems critical to our financial statement audits. These audits determine whether the state's computer systems adequately protect public funds and electronic information and whether they operate as intended. The IT audit recommendations are directed at improving electronic information security practices and procedures. In addition to our core audit functions, we have other responsibilities. The audit division is responsible for administering the municipal audit law.
Let me ask you a question really quick before we move on. Can you go back a single slide? Would it compromise the independent assessment if the audits division periodically coordinated with the legislative fiscal office in determining certain agencies that ought to have a look over?
Well, in a later slide, we are the co-chairs and members of the committee. JLAC, the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, it was kind of silent for many years, and then in 2015 it became more active, and we've been meeting with them quarterly. During this session, we are meeting with them every 2 weeks, and we are tackling that issue.
And so I don't serve on that committee. So does the committee make a request to you folks to look at certain issues?
Okay, co-chairs and members of the committee, in the law, they work with the Secretary of State's office for audit ideas, and they've been pretty silent. So we're trying to, the Secretary sent them a letter a couple weeks ago soliciting their ideas to see what they want audited, what's relevant to them, what do they want audited. And then we plan in the future, they're meeting every 2 weeks on Tuesdays, to kind of narrow that down, what ideas are of interest to them, and are these feasible audit ideas.
Yeah, I appreciate that. What I would share is that your Ways and Means Committee quite often can be the eyes and ears of outstanding issues that may need to have a review. And, LFO does their analysis, but you folks obviously have a level of expertise you could bring to the table as well. And so that's interesting that perhaps there could be a greater level of communication and coordination.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, in the past, we've interacted with LFO sometimes when we start performance audits to see if they've encountered any issues with agencies. And several years ago, I've worked with some LFO analysts on a couple of issues.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
Okay. The audits division is responsible for administering municipal audit law. We have approximately 2 FTE dedicated to this function. There are about 1,800 local governments in Oregon, and all are required to submit some level of revenue and expenditure report to the audits division each year. Those that have over $500,000 in annual expenditures are required to have an audit. About 1,200 municipalities are required to have and to submit an audit, an annual financial statement to the audits division each year. We annually conduct desk reviews on about 100 of those audit reports that are submitted to help ensure proper financial accounting and to ensure municipalities receive consistent professional audit services from their contracted CPAs. For report deficiencies identified, we send letters to the municipalities and to the CPA firms, and if we see serious reporting deficiencies, we will share the results with the Board of Accountancy. The municipal audit manager has long been involved in the Oregon Society of CPAs. We feel this is a very important relationship. It helps us to be aware of issues municipal auditors face and to provide training when needed. Over the years, we've tried different ways to encourage municipalities to file their annual reports on time, which is generally considered to be 1 year after their fiscal year end. We've sent numerous letters, made several phone contacts. We've even visited, done field visits with these entities. Starting about 4 years ago, we started posting a delinquent list to our website of those municipalities that had not filed the reports and were a year or more past due. In 2015, at the request of the Secretary, House Bill 2174 was introduced. This bill amended municipal audit law to provide us some more teeth to encourage the timely filing of audit reports by cities and counties. Basically, the law allows the Secretary to initiate withholding of 10% of state distributions to a county or city until they file their delinquent report. We've communicated the change in law via letters, our annual municipal audit newsletter, and phone contacts. We didn't want anybody caught off guard. Without even initiating the withholding, the change in law has had an impact. Several cities that were several years behind are now caught up. We have a few that are still delinquent, and they're two small cities, and so we are in final determinations if we are going to start withholding later this year.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please.
Do they give you any reasons other than we're just small? I mean,
co-chairs, members of the committee, they do. Some of these cities, they're very small, and they might only have one accountant. If that accountant gets sick, gets, you know, a serious or illness, it's hard to replace because it's hard to find another accountant that's local. One of the entities, it's hard for them to find a CPA firm as well. One of the CPA firms that is doing this for this small community is located like 3 hours away. So trying to work with them and to get their records in order can be a challenge. But we really feel strongly that for their citizens, if they get caught up, it's easier to stay caught up than to get behind. And their main concern is if they aren't having these done timely, there could be something that's not appropriately that's going on.
I don't want you to name the cities. The point is not to shame them, but it seems to me if someone's responsible, a city council or a mayor, for running a municipality, that it ought to be of prime concern to them to make sure that their books are in order. And I don't know whether there's any way that you in the secretary's office could help them get a single accountant to help do multiple tiny municipalities. I think it's too bad that you have to threaten to withhold funds in order to motivate them to do what I think is a foundational civic responsibility.
I agree. Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'll name this one entity because we work with them. Wilhelmina was they were several years behind, and we work with them. We met with the mayor over the last 18 months, and they're getting caught up. There's a consultant out of Portland who's working with them and working with another entity as well. The mayor and the recorder, city recorder, very much want to make this change, and it's been a great collaboration, and so they've made great strides.
Good.
But there is a consultant out there, and there are consultants that can help them.
Thank you.
We also administer the government waste hotline, which was set in statute as a way for public employees and citizens to report fraud, waste, or abuse in state programs. We have a team that triages the calls to determine if they fall under fraud, waste, or abuse of state funds. If they do, we have a team that includes certified fraud examiners and management to review those calls more in depth. We investigate the calls, perform follow-up procedures as necessary, and prepare an annual report summarizing the calls. Last year, we had 206 hotline calls. Other work we conduct also includes work that financial staff conduct in between their annual.
I'd like to go back.
Please.
Mm-hmm. Do you notice any pattern in those calls? Because I can imagine all sorts of things motivate them, a disgruntled employee or a genuine discovery of malfeasance. Do you track them or group them in any way or draw any conclusions from the pattern of the call?
Co-chairs and members of the committee, in the annual report, we do group the calls. A few by name ago, we had changes so that we could refer certain calls because we were getting a lot of HR-related calls, and we feel that those are best handled at the agency. So if they're HR-related, we will refer those to the agency. But in the report, we do group calls. And, you know, there's a variety. There's not one set. We get a variety of calls.
What I'm looking for is a conversation that took place in this same committee the other day about whether or not you would have the ability then to work with an agency if the issue came up several times, whether you'd reach out to the agency head, whether you would take any unilateral constructive action on your own part, or other than just taking the report and writing noted, what do you do?
Okay, co-chairs and members of the committee, we have a 24/7 hotline call. It's a database, so they will get a live operator. They will talk to that person. It may talk for an hour, and that person will write down all their call. They can send in documentation that is attached to that database. We have a triage team that's going through those files every week, listening to the calls. If it's an anonymous, we can put information back in that database for the caller, say, hey, we don't have any information to follow up on. Can you please submit more information? So then the triage team goes around and we discuss those calls, and we're saying, hey, is this a state issue? Is this falls under state authority? Do we feel there's an issue here? Then we will start investigative procedures. We will most likely contact internal auditors to let them know or see if they've encountered this issue before, and then we will go to the entities and start investigating the call. Further, if we do see a pattern in calls, or not even in the hotline calls, we also get correspondence just coming through the secretary's office and through our office. If there is a pattern, then that might, for us, consider doing an audit.
Okay.
Thank you. Other work we conduct also includes work that financial staff conduct in between their annual financial and federal audits. The financial staff conduct risk assessments at smaller state agencies. Financial statements audits that are required by law of bond programs that are not part of the annual state audit, and other financial statement audits required either by state or federal law. One of the biggest challenges we have faced over the years was timely access to information. Agencies, as they should be, are very protective of information and oftentimes put up roadblocks before providing information necessary for us to conduct our audits. Over the last couple of years, we've worked with agencies and DOJ to develop a standard data sharing agreement designed to alleviate some of the impediments. We have seen great improvements in this process. We still have a little ways to go, but we've seen improvement. Another challenge we face with limited resources are mandated and ballot measure audits. These audits affect our audit resources, especially if these mandates are reoccurring audits. We monitor legislation and we provide input during the process about the topic, whether we are the right entity to conduct the audit, if that's what's required in legislation, and if the mandate is feasible. We've started a conversation with the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, with the goal being to filter these requests through the committee rather than through a mandate. Earlier this month, the Secretary, as I said, sent a letter to JLAC soliciting audit ideas. Another challenge we have is balancing our performance audit priorities. We conduct performance audits that help improve operations and others that help agencies more effectively achieve their missions. Some audits generate savings, while the results of other audits are not always immediately measurable. We plan to continue to conduct a variety of performance audits and have increased our communication about the benefits of the different types of audits. We will discuss this challenge in more depth when we discuss our KPMs. We do have one policy package for two more IT auditors. We currently have 7 IT auditors and are seeking approval for 2 more, increasing the division's FTE from 72 to 74 FTE. The division's IT auditors perform required audits to determine the reliability of computer processed information that's used to prepare our state's financial statements. The required work limits the capacity to meet the growing demand for IT security audits. A recent IT audit of key security controls released in November of 2016, we went to 13 state agencies. The governor's executive order requiring the agency to work with the state CIO to identify risk illustrates the need for agencies to improve the identification, the assessment, and the mitigation of IT security risks throughout the state. Additional auditors sufficiently trained in IT security are needed to address the increase in the need for security audits. As you can see, with the 2 positions we are seeking, we will be staffed at the level we were at 30 years ago. Back in the 1980s, all 75 staff conducted financial audits. Starting in 1990, performance audits were introduced with a staff of 5 performance auditors. Several years later, we started IT audits. Due to automation, changes in processes and in programs, our FTE needed to complete our financial and federal responsibilities has decreased over time from 75 to 33 FTE. Today, our 72 FTE is comprised of 33 financials, 27 performance, 7 IT, 2 municipal, 1 hotline, and 2 support staff. Now I'm going to turn it over to Will Garber. He's the Deputy Director for Performance Audits, and he's going to discuss our KPIs.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Will Garber. I'm Deputy Director at the Audits Division, and I'm going to give you a brief summary of the 3 KPIs we have for the Audits Division. The first one is a measure of dollar impact of our audits, and it's basically the sum of the revenue enhancements, savings, and question costs we identify in our performance audits in a given fiscal year. As you can see from this first slide, it varies quite a bit from year to year. We've missed our target in some years. Over the last 5 years, on average, we've been above the target. And how we do with this measure in a given year really depends on how many audits we complete that have measurable dollar impacts. Mary referred to this earlier. We are always trying to select audits that will have significant benefits in terms of improving program effectiveness and efficiency. But many of those benefits that we identify, we just can't translate into dollar terms. In fact, over the last several years, we've focused on topics that can help an agency or program better achieve its mission. And these audits often don't have measurable dollar impacts. Just wanted to give you one example. It's our audit at Oregon Housing and Community Services. In that audit, we found that OHCS needed to improve its affordable housing preservation efforts, strategic planning, data management, and also needed to resolve some fundamental organizational challenges. This one, like other audits we complete, where we had significant benefits for Oregonians that weren't measurable in dollar terms. But as the Secretary mentioned yesterday, though, audits that have potential to generate dollar impacts are important, and we'll continue to put them on our schedule. But I do think that we can expect this measure to move up and down like we've seen, like we see on the chart there, move up and down from year to year. So moving on to our second KPM, it's dollars returned per dollar spent on performance audits. This measure really just takes the first KPM that I discussed earlier and divides it by the cost of our audits. And we measure audit costs by multiplying the number of hours we spend on audits by an average cost per hour. And our performance on this measure basically tracks the first KPM that I discussed. As you can see, it's been up and down over the past 5 years. Let's see, and I just wanted to mention, too, that those same caveats that I mentioned about the first KPM apply to this one as well.
Can you share with me the difference between KPM number 2 and 3? One, it looks to me like 2 is just divided by the cost of the audit to get to number 3.
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, that's exactly what it is. The first KPM number 2 is just a straight dollar estimate of the dollar impacts of the audits we've done. The second one just divides that by cost, audit cost.
To me, it would seem like, and maybe Mr. Secretary of State, this is something we'll visit in the future about. To me, it seemed like there ought to be a third KPM rather than taking 2 of them and just putting a spin on one of them.
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, sure, we'd be happy to talk about those. It would be possible for us to just have a KPM on audit cost, if that's what you're thinking.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it seems like the two could be combined into some form of measure that looks at that efficiency.
Sure.
And maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. To me, it just seems like they're the same. Let's continue.
Then I just wanted to move on to our third KPM, this percentage of our audit recommendations that are implemented. Just to give you a little bit of background, each year we follow up with agencies about our audit recommendations. We ask them to report the implementation status of each recommendation we make. In the most recent fiscal year, we were about 88% of recommendations implemented, and that's been pretty consistent over the years. I just wanted to mention that we have a couple other ways in which we follow up on recommendations. If we think an agency is not making particularly good progress implementing recommendations we've made, we may devote an entire audit to going back and trying to understand why they're not making good progress. Also, for any audit that's underway, if there are prior audit recommendations that relate to the objective of the current audit, we follow up on those as well.
Representative Gumber.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you for this information. It seems to me that this test of whether or not a recommendation was implemented is not an absolute measurement. Are you looking and saying, yes, this recommendation was was exceeded or implemented by 100%? Are you using a, they got pretty close to it enough that we're satisfied, or that they're making a reasonable effort? What's the test on whether or not a recommendation has actually been satisfied?
Co-chair, so Representative Gomberg, maybe just a little bit more detail on the process that we use to follow up on recommendations. The annual process I mentioned involves sending an agency basically a form that they fill out for each recommendation we've made, and we ask them to basically categorize their process. So to a large degree, that information is self-reported. We ask them to either say it's been fully implemented, it's been partially implemented, we're in progress, we're still working on it, it's been partially implemented, we're done working on it, we declined to implement it, or we just haven't started yet. So we get the recommendations categorized in those three areas. Some do end in just partial implementation. That's as far as they get. When we calculate this KPM, we try and give ourselves some credit for those as well.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the recommendations that are related to financial or federal audits, those we actually have to go out and we test and verify what they're saying, the recommendation that they've implemented. It's required by standard.
Just one of the co-chairs.
What ability do you have to implement? I'm struggling with this one, and I'm on your side on this, okay? I'm struggling. If an agency chooses not to implement it, even though it's a great recommendation, it could be the best recommendation in the world, makes all the sense in the world. If the agency chooses not to do it, it reflects on your KPM.
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, it sure does. Now, I should say that we really do try to work with agencies when we develop our recommendations to come up with things that get at the root causes of the problems we've identified, but that are also feasible and cost-effective. So we have some, you know, back and forth with agencies about those. So we hope we're reaching something that they will implement. Now, it does happen on occasion that they just decline to implement the recommendation. I mentioned earlier, I said it in maybe a little bit more diplomatic terms, but if an agency is really not taking action, we can go back and do another audit and find out why and hopefully make a case for them to do it. An example of that comes to mind recently is we've had a series of audits at the State Data Center around security there. And we've seen, I think, recurring problems from one audit to the next. So we've gone there, we've tried to re-audit in those cases and tried to get at what the reasons were for the agency not taking up our recommendations. But ultimately, you're right. The agency has the discretion to decide whether or not they're going to implement the recommendation. They're not required to implement our recommendations.
Yeah. Well, obviously, Mr. Secretary of State, you have the call of where you choose to go with this. But to me, KPM number 4 seems like it also needs to be adjusted a little bit to where it's perhaps more fair for you folks, and holds the agencies.
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, I don't know if this helps much, but that 88% recommendation of recommendations implemented is pretty comparable to other audit organizations. They're in that same ballpark too. So that's the brief summary I had. I'd be happy to try and answer any other questions if you have them.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Co-chair, member of the committee, we'll continue with slide 77. We would like to highlight some of the results from 2016. We issued 37 audit reports. We responded to numerous hotline calls, information calls, and numerous public records requests. Some of these take a lot of experience and skill. For example, some hotline calls require spending hours on the phone with individuals, making several callbacks, reviewing various documentation, collecting and reviewing documentation at state agencies. In addition, we receive several public records requests which require that we methodically and carefully review each working paper and that we redact anything that is protected under public records law. We could not do what we do.
May I?
Yeah, please. Of course.
You used the word redact and it caused me to think of something. You're a professional auditor, right? Have you ever heard of an audit being prepared with proprietary information, and I use that word very specifically, it was characterized as proprietary information, that had to be redacted prior to being issued into the public space?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, what I can speak to is when we contract out for some audits as well, and in those contracts, a lot of the firms feel like their information is proprietary. They might have a methodology that they want to protect, and so that is considered proprietary. Maybe we can speak to the ODOT, but in the ODOT recently issued ODOT report, some of the information in the bids was considered proprietary. So when we get a public records request, and recently a lot of the requests come from the media, we have to go through, you almost have to have an attorney's eye to go through and redact anything that's protected, because we don't want to be in a legal situation.
Follow up, Mr. Please. Chair. So the fact that an audit or a management profile was paid for with public money, it was of a public agency, an auditing firm could employ methodologies that were considered sufficiently proprietary to that firm's methodology, that it is not uncommon that they would be redacted in a copy that would then be available in the public square.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, that's been my experience. So when we come to those situations where an entity might want to push the envelope a little, we go to DOJ and we work with them to see what can we redact, because we err on the side of being conservative. We don't want to, we want to share what's public, but we want to make sure we don't cross that line. And so we will seek guidance from DOJ if we think, if the firm is maybe being overly protected, and this really is public information. So on the audit that was released, well, it was an investigative review of Betsy last.
Careful.
I know, sorry. released last September, business energy tax credits. So with that, when we had to work with DOJ, because initially some of the information was thought to be protected, and then going through DOJ, it was not protected. So some of the information in the files we could share, and others, if they used a methodology, we had to work with the Department of Energy, because they had the contract with these entities to say what part of their methodologies were protected. It gets to be very...
One more. I know it's complicated, but I'm trying to understand this. Most of my service where auditors have been employed is on not-for-profit boards, and I'm still trying to understand how in a public space one wouldn't know ahead of time that a firm was going to employ analytics that could be considered proprietary and therefore could be redacted. So that's question number one. And question number two, has it ever been your experience that if there is a request for redaction, let's take the Betsy situation, there were some allegations of bad actors in that situation. A professional audit would not allow the bad actors to be redacted, but it might allow proprietary analytics to be redacted, correct?
Correct.
Okay. I'm just, Mr. Chair, what I'm getting at is just how sanitized a document is if the firm providing the service alleges that they have employed proprietary analytics, and we have no ability to make an independent judgment of what those proprietary analytics were. Lawyers behind a screen do. And I'm just trying to understand, first of all, how the state doing a public audit would get into a situation where there were proprietary analytics and nobody knew that in advance. And secondly, I'm trying to figure out what ended up redacted that might be of interest to the public in a very high profile operational and management review. So, and you've helped me. I thought this was absolutely anomalous, and you've confirmed for me that it does happen in other situations. Okay. That answer alone was worth the ponderous path to get there.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. We cannot do what we do without the caliber of audit staff that we have. We have a very collaborative workforce dedicated to improving Oregon government. We aren't always loved by our auditees, but our goal is to improve Oregon government, and that is what we strive to do one audit at a time. During 2016, several of our audit staff provided training to other state agencies. They provided training at intergovernmental audit forums in other states. They provided training nationally via webinars and provided training at national conferences in other states. We completed 11 performance audits during this time. As you can see, we audited at several agencies covering various topics and risks. The TSPC audit and the Smarter Balance or Summative Assessment audits were mandated audits. The ODFW and the WRD water resources audits were dealt with fundamental strategic issues. The ODF audit pertained to natural resources, and the Department of Ag dealt with public safety issues. We really try to cover a broad base when we determine our audit plan for the year. We also completed several financial audits during the year, the largest being our audit of the Oregon's financial statements, the Oregon Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, and our single audit report. Our IT staff worked on two major audits during the year. As previously stated, the audit of the state's computer system entailed audit work at 13 state agencies. In addition to audits, we issued a variety of other reports. Most in the news was our contract for the investigative examination of the business energy tax credits. And to wrap up, we protect the state's resources by examining the security of state computer applications and controls, by auditing agency internal controls to ensure the money is properly managed, by auditing to ensure state agencies are using state resources effectively and efficiently, and by staying vigilant for fraud in all of our audit efforts and responding to fraud hotline calls. The Audits Division will continue to focus on our goal of more than 20 years, which is auditing to protect the public interest and improve Oregon government. We will continue to focus on our mission and goals to complete financial audits on time, performance audits that promote the effective and efficient use of state resources, IT audits that focus on the critical needs of the state and IT security vulnerabilities, hotline investigations addressing fraud, waste, and abuse, and our municipal audit law responsibilities. That concludes my presentation. I'm happy to respond to any additional questions that you may have.
Let me ask a couple of questions here. How often or how large of an issue is it that your auditors are getting cherry-picked off by departments within the state of Oregon? And then let me follow up with that question. How do you balance the integrity of audit when you know it at any point in time your auditors may be applying for employment elsewhere or being recruited elsewhere?
Okay. Co-chairs and members of the committee, we often, our times are seen as a training ground. We try to stay up on the latest and greatest, and our auditors are challenged, and they want to be challenged. These are very smart people. They like challenges. They want work to be interesting. So we try to keep a variety of audits going to maintain them. Now, in the past, I mean, it's getting really tough to commute to Portland a lot. So we've had teleworking. Teleworking is generally limited to 1 or 2 days. It's usually a Thursday or Friday. The Portland commute, that's helped retain those folks. So I think we're very vigilant on that, trying to give them the training they need, the skills, give them the job opportunities on audits to retain them. For your second question dealt with the...
So is it an issue that you're losing?
Well,
the turnover?
Well, I've been there since 1990, and it kind of goes in swings. When the economy goes down, we might have a freeze where we have a hiring freeze. We have during the time that I'm recalling, what was most severe was when we had the furloughs and the merit freezes. We probably were down 15 staff because we could not hire staff. Within 2 or 3 years, we got back up to full staff. And then it depends what happens in the cities and counties. If you're a Portland person and the city of Portland has an opening, we kind of know, Will knows, he's a Portland commuter, we might lose someone. We've lost someone to Multnomah County, Clackamas, City of Portland. So we do our best to keep them. Now, if someone is interested in applying for a job within the state, we have independent standards that they are required to comply with. Every year we have them comply with a statement. If they are interested in a job, they have to notify us immediately, or it could be disciplinary action. In my history with the division, there's been one time when we've counseled someone and it happened again, and we let the person go. We have to maintain that integrity. So we have a pretty tight line there.
Perfect. Thank you. Colleagues, any other questions or comments? All righty. Okay. Anything else you want to share with us?
Nope. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well done.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I have one, the Secretary may be able to answer it. He may want to throw out a lifeline. But I'm just curious, in your work with state agencies, You prepare a document, and I presume there's some kind of it's embargoed for some period of time. Is there an established protocol prescribed and easily understood by agencies about honoring those embargoes prior to the release? Or have you discussed with DAS a standardization of the policy? Because you're going to, I presume, in your service as Secretary of State, do a number of state audits. And I just wonder if everybody knows what the rules of engagement are.
Mr. Co-Chair, and members of the committee, Senator Johnson, there is an established protocol. We've changed a little bit since I've come on board, in that we now are going to be holding a meeting with legislators the night before a report, an audit report, is released, so that the legislators will be able to understand what's going on. They'll have the information so that they'll be prepared for calls that come in the next morning. We're releasing that also to the press early. There's an embargo on it. They agree that there will be nothing mentioned until the actual release on the morning that the release is to take place. The agencies in the past have also honored the embargo because we've given them copies early. With the recent ODOT audit report, the director of ODOT chose not to honor that embargo and release the information early with a draft, not even the final report. And for his own reasons, I met with him, we discussed it, explained to him that we have the option of not providing information early to an agency and just let them read it in the papers like anybody else. And that's what we could do if they would not cooperate. We reached an agreement that we would start fresh, and that there would not be such a violation in the future. Steve Elzinga, my legislative and legal advisors, met with the staff in the governor's office, and they've agreed that they will talk with their agency heads to ensure that there is an honoring of the agreement, that if they get information early, it does not get released early. So we're going forward.
Mr. Chair, this is not an attempt to track down and punish the guilty. It is more to establish an acceptable protocol. I think everybody wants to play by the rules, but it's necessary that the rules be clear and easily understood and disseminated to all parties. So thank you. This unfortunate situation may have been foundational in that it will create a platform for everybody to understand what the rules of engagement are.
Thank you. I agree. That's correct. Mr. Co-Chair, we'd like to now invite Mary Beth Herkert to come forward and give us the report from the Archives Division.
Perfect. Wonderful. Welcome. If you could just introduce yourself for the record, the floor is yours.
So, good afternoon, Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Manning, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I am the Director of the Secretary of State's Archives Division. Thank you for this opportunity to present the Archives Division budget proposal for 2017-19. The Archives Division began operations in 1947 to house and provide access to the permanently valuable records of Oregon government and to authorize the disposition of public records from all of Oregon's governmental entities. Today, the Archives Division is the state's information broker and information manager, and we strive to make as much government information available to the public, whether by accessing this information in a traditional manner, looking at physically the records at the Archives Building, using the Oregon Blue Book or administrative rules, or by using our website to access the ever-growing amount of information and records added on a daily basis. In addition, the division works with every state agency and political subdivision to help them manage their information, regardless of its format, from creation until final disposition, helping to ensure the citizens of Oregon that their government is transparent and accountable. Our budget request for the 2017-2019 biennium includes the following: $7,974,590 other funds, the majority of which is collected through assessments. We do have a very small portion of other funds that is miscellaneous receipts, which includes the cost for copies of public records, a fee for non-specific research requests, sales of photographs that my staff have taken, and the sale of bags with historic trademarks. We also receive federal funds in the form of grants from the National Historic Publications and Records Commission. The limitation on this slide reflects the carryover from previous grants from the from the NHPRC for the State Historic Records Advisory Board. However, we have not been able to secure funding for these grants for the past 2 years due to the NHPRC's budget cuts. We'll try again this year and have also been looking at other granting entities that allow government agencies to apply for funding. If we do receive funding, we will work with Mr. Bender to determine the appropriate amount of federal limitation we will need for the 2017-2019 biennium. The work that the Archives Division performs centers on making government information accessible, ensuring that it is managed in the most efficient manner possible, and that the state's historical records are preserved. We do this with a current staff of 22 full-time employees, representing a reference unit with 6 archivists, which includes the manager and 1 support staff, records management with 6 records management analysts, which also includes the manager, 2 full-time employees staffing the State Records Center, and 1 full-time employee that staffs the Security Copy Depository, and a publications unit with 4 full-time employees. The other
Mr.
two
positions. Just a curiosity, and this stems from the fact I was reading an article about pilferage of ancient documents from some large, well-known global archives. Have we had much of a problem with people slipping a razor blade along the back of a book and pages disappear or any of the rest of that? Are we pretty good about not stealing our priceless written word?
Co-chairs and Senator Johnson, we have been very fortunate that that has not happened to us. Unfortunately, the person who was one of my early mentors worked for New York State Archives and did the exact same thing as an archivist, was selling New York State's revolutionary period records, and was punished severely in jail for a number of years. But no, we take it very seriously.
You wouldn't look good in orange.
No. our reference room is monitored whenever anybody is in there, and we also inspect bags. I mean, when patrons come into our reference room, they are not allowed to bring anything in except for their laptop, which has to be out of the case, or they can have a pad of paper and a pencil, and that they cannot bring jackets, purses, backpacks, or anything that could inadvertently carry something out.
Are there also protocols for the physical handling of some of these priceless documents, wherein they would have to have gloves or they would have to have an archivist there with them to actually help manipulate the written treasures?
Co-chair Senator Johnson, yes, especially any of our territorial records or some of the early statehood records. Our Constitution, which I'll get into later, that really doesn't ever see the light of day except for on the state's birthday. Any of those records that are particularly fragile or in bad shape, they have to be handled by an archivist. We won't even let patrons handle them. Sometimes when patrons are handling photographs, we require them to wear gloves as well.
Thank you.
You know, Senator, you and I have been here
a while.
I don't recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't recall the Secretary of State's office ever requesting additional upgrades to maintaining these artifacts. What's the condition of the archive in terms of its ability to do it at a state-of-the-art level?
Co-chairs, the biggest issue is in the early 1990s, late 1980s, is getting the building that we are in. It is environmentally controlled 24/7. That goes a long way to protecting the records, paper records, as well as some of our other formats that we have. In addition, we rebox and refolder our records into acid-free containers so that there's not outside elements coming in and affecting the records. So we have been very fortunate. When I first started working at the State Archives, we were in the Hops Warehouse over there by JK Carpets, and it was absolutely awful. There was mold on the walls. There was all sorts of swings. We had homeless people sleeping in the stacks on a regular basis. So we are very fortunate to be in the facility that we are and have been able to mitigate some of that.
Let me ask one more question, and I apologize. I should know this, but I just don't. How do you decipher what's an artifact versus what I think is a cool keepsake? And then let me follow up on that. How do you determine what you're going to keep as an original versus what you're going to put on, I guess we don't use film anymore, whatever, the digital? How do you decipher that?
Co-Chair Smith, it's part of our professional training and our professional education. When we try to determine what is an historical record versus what's just kind of cool to have, we look at four basic values that a record has, which is legal, fiscal, administrative, and historical. And by historical, we mean does it have long-term value to the citizens of Oregon? It requires us to know what an agency does, what its main focus and mission is, so that we are capturing only those records that are basically have that long-term value. The percentage we use in a profession is about 3% of all records created have historical value. How we determine what format we're going to keep them in, it used to be really easy. When I started, it was paper or microfilm. Now that we've gotten into a lot of different formats, we face a lot of issues. And I'll get into this a little bit later, but we are at a point now that we're confident with our electronic records management system that we're using that we can accept long-term electronic records as permanent as long as we designate a particular format that has become a de facto standard, such as PDF, MP3, MP4. And so we will allow those to be retained as historical records.
Let me ask one last question, then we'll move on. Are there just certain records where we just keep the original?
Absolutely.
Can you give this committee just a couple examples of what might constitute in today's society, what would constitute an original document we'd want to keep?
Well, the original Constitution is obvious. But if you're looking at what's being created today.
Speaker Kotek gives a speech.
Yes. The records of the Secretary of State, the records of the governor, the records of the state treasurer, those all carry long-term value. If you're looking at state agencies, you're going to look at anything, well, local governments, anything that establishes boundaries, land use planning, that sort of thing. Those are all going to be permanent records.
Perfect. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Please continue.
Yes. So these program areas provide a wide variety of services to a very diverse customer base made up of the general public, elected officials, private sector businesses, and the over 3,000 state agencies and political subdivisions in Oregon. Our services include preserving and making the permanently valuable records of Oregon government available via the web, in person, by mail or phone, so that the customer can trace their family's roots, establish a property line, determine the intent of a particular law or statute, or look to see how a particular event in Oregon in history affected Oregonians. Providing state agencies and political subdivisions with advice and assistance on a variety of public records issues and right retention and disposition schedules, helping to ensure that agencies manage their public records in the most effective and efficient way possible. In addition, our customers also rely on the records managers to interpret and explain new laws and federal mandates and how these may affect their records and ultimate disposition. The records managers and archivists rely on their professional education and training to not only identify Oregon's historical records while working in an agency, but to ensure that they are transferred to the archives, preserved, and made accessible as well. We also manage a statewide electronic records management system called the Oregon Records Management Solution, which allows the tiniest special districts to the largest state agencies the ability to ensure the integrity of the records as well as to manage their information from creation until final disposition in a single system, making the management of public records systematic, routine, and cost-effective. And this is all done while allowing easy access to this information through a web portal. We create standards and update laws to ensure that the use of technology will not compromise the retention, integrity, or accessibility to public records. We operate the State Records Center, which provides state agencies with inexpensive storage for their records until they have met their authorized retention period. They are also then destroyed in a timely manner so that an agency does not continue to pay for the storage of records that are no longer needed to conduct the state's business. We receive and publish the administrative rules from state agencies and boards and commissions, and any changes to the administrative rules are published in the monthly are published monthly and annually, ensuring that agencies and citizens alike have access to the most current rules. In addition, we are also responsible for updating and publishing the Oregon Blue Book. We accept for filing the state's official documents, and we also administer the state's historical record, State Historic Records Advisory Board, which in turn works with all state's historical societies, museums, and archives to provide advice and assistance, train and assist with the federal granting process. So we'll go into our program areas. Our reference unit acts as the state's information broker by providing access to the permanent records of Oregon's government and by directing the public to the proper agency for records that are more current. Our customer base is diverse, and so are the records that they use. We have developed numerous indices and finding aids to help patrons access the records of Oregon government, including the Early Oregonians Database, a county historical records guide, and an offshoot of the Oregon Records Management Solution, a web portal called WebDrawer that allows patrons to readily access archives holdings as they are digitized.
We have a question for you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just out of curiosity, you know, there's been a lot in the news about FOIA requests. Do you receive a lot of FOIA requests? What is the process of handling that? And is there a cost associated with that, you know, in terms of, you know, how long? I guess it probably would depend on the what the request is. And so can you tell me a little bit of something about those? Are you receiving those in particular to any particular agency?
Co-chairs and co-chair Senator Manning, we don't actually fulfill public records requests for other state agencies. We will work our own agency's public records request. If an agency has records that are being stored at the state archives that are permanent records and they need access to them to satisfy the public records request, then we do get involved. But if it's for current records, the state agency works to gather those themselves. However, in our statewide electronic records management system, we do work with all of the agencies that are in that system to help them satisfy those requests. And it makes it a lot easier to search. The search capability in that system, for example, we did have one request for the Secretary of State's office that wanted all the email from the Secretary of State from a previous Secretary of State from the date they started until right before the election again. And we were able to return 83,000 emails in about 90 seconds because they were in our system. So we really encourage agencies to use the Oregon Records Management Solution.
So for that particular case, is there a dollar amount or anything like that that's assessed? Or no, since it's electronic, that you can just push the button then, huh?
If Senator Manning, if it's in the Oregon Records Management Solution, we rarely charge because it's so fast.
Okay.
If they actually want physical copies of all the records, then we would probably charge a copying fee. But most of them just basically take the list, they look at it, and then they ask us for particular records.
Okay, so one follow-up. So when sending it out electronically like that, how do you deal with it as far as any type of sensitive data? What is the process involved in that?
Senator Manning, our process is before the records are even ingested into the system, they are ranked on a 1 to 4 level as to what their security access is, 1 being the lowest access, 4 being the highest. And it's based on the system that the legislature had set back in the early 2000s. So when records are put into the system, they're pre-classified as to whether or not there is information in there that needs to be redacted or is sensitive, and then we only have to review those records. So we do a lot of work on the front end to make sure that access on the back end is very quick and easy to do.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Please continue.
Okay, so reference services are driven by a demand for information, which is a combination of customer need and awareness of available services. We create demand by constantly adding new information to the web. For example, the oaths of office from 2010 to the present are a heavily requested record, and the 1967 and 1969 legislative audio, which includes the beach, bottle, land use, and minimum wage bills, was recorded in a now defunct format and were unable to be heard. So we looked at the demand for those records, and we were able to digitize both the oaths and the audio, put it into our web portal, so that any member of the public can now access these records or listen to the audio from their home computer. So they don't even have to come to the archives anymore to get that information. We've also successfully completed phase two of the move from traditional shelving to compact shelving, and hope to complete phase three in the 2017-19 biennium, which I will cover in our package 109. And again, all of our reference units, our activities are designed to promote government transparency. Our records management unit acts as the state's information manager. We do this by providing the state's 3,000 plus governmental entities with advice and assistance, training, records retention schedules, technology standards, and a statewide electronic records management system for all of government to use. Our goal is to have agencies only keep information for as long as it is necessary to conduct a public's business, and to keep that information accessible to the public from creation till final disposition, helping to ensure that Oregon's government remains accountable and transparent. Managing electronic information continues to be problematic and costly for the state, not only from a storage standpoint, but from a legal one as well. And since 2012, we have been offering all agencies at all levels of government the opportunity to manage their electronic records in the Oregon Records Management Solution. The Oregon Records Management Solution is a software as a service solution with a unique twist. The Archives Records Management Unit provides the implementation, integration, and training on the software to agencies wanting to participate, while our private partner, Shafts Consulting in Baker City, Oregon, operates the hardware, software, and help desk in a private government cloud. We now have 52 agencies, up from 22 that I reported in 2015. These agencies vary in size and represent every level of government in Oregon. Our fastest growing user group is school districts. 9 have been added in the last year and a half, and as they have found that the ability to manage and securely transfer Oregon student records in the Oregon Records Management Solution is not only cost-effective, but offers them the opportunity to easily and securely transfer student records between districts. In addition, the State of Washington, Secretary of State, Colorado, Wyoming are also actively using the Oregon Records Management Solution, and Sweden and Botswana have adopted the model after consulting and obtaining the necessary information from us. In 2016, the Oregon Records Management Solution underwent a Criminal Justice Information Services audit, the CJIS audit, by the state police for compliance to maintain criminal justice information in the system. We successfully obtained our CJIS compliance certification, allowing us to work with police departments, the early childhood division, and other entities that are required to retain criminal justice information. It was quite an accomplishment, and it took about a year to achieve. Finally, the Records Management Unit has continued its successful operation of the State Record Center and Security Copy Depository, with 2 full-time employees servicing 90,000 boxes of records, pulling and refiling records for state agencies with 100% accuracy rate in less than 24 hours. The State Record Center continues to be one of the state's best bargains. Our publications unit is responsible for receiving, for filing, verifying, publishing, and maintaining Oregon's administrative rules for state agencies and boards and commissions. We publish an online monthly bulletin that includes notifications of rulemaking actions, including any changes, additions, or deletions to the agency's administrative rules. We also print an annual compilation of all the state's administrative rules, maintain this information online, and provide advice and assistance and training to state agency rules coordinators. The process used to do this has not really changed in over 20 years, resulting in delays of publication of up to 6 weeks. The number of rulemaking actions continues to increase, and the ability to search the online rules is cumbersome at best. Where we once printed over 3,000 sets of the annual compilation, we now print 63, and it takes nearly 3 months to produce. Because of all of this, we have spent the last biennium developing the Oregon Administrative Rules Database, which is scheduled to go live in June. This database streamlines the rulemaking process by allowing agencies to write and file their rules in a secure database, submit them to our publications unit, where they are published as soon as they are verified and being accurate and complete. This means that all rulemaking actions will be available to the public as soon as they are published, rather than having a 2 to 6 week delay. And the rules database provides the public with a robust search engine capable of searching across all rule text and rulemaking actions. So instead of having to format and print an annual compilation, the database will feature a print-on-demand component, allowing those who want a print version of the rules to do so on an as-needed basis. The publications unit is also responsible for updating and publishing both the online and in-print Oregon Blue Book. The 2017-18 Blue Book has a theme of outdoor recreation and features a beautiful cover photo of the Milky Way taken from a campsite in the Three Sisters Wilderness, a back cover picture of Yaquina Head Lighthouse at sunset, a color insert of the Pacific Crest Trail, a history of outdoor recreation in Oregon, updated agency descriptions to focus more on the missions and functions of the agency, and finally, the essays written by Oregon's elementary and middle school students about Oregon's outdoors and the recreational opportunities that they like best. Our budget drivers and challenges. Our first one is workload increases. And although this is a challenge, we view it as a positive in that the workload increases mean that what we are doing is actually making government more accessible, accountable, and transparent, which means we are meeting our goals. The Oregon's records management solution continues to grow with 52 participating agencies. And because of our small staff with competing priorities in records management, we have looked and streamlined our onboarding process for Oregon Records Management Solution to get more agencies on board more quickly. The publications unit continues to see increases in rulemaking activity, and again, with small staff, find a way to do things more efficiently. In 2014, we sat down and went through a lean process to eliminate redundancies. And as I stated earlier, we'll be going live with the Oregon Administrative Rules Database. And this will not only make Oregon's administrative rules process more transparent and all rulemaking activities more accessible, it will allow staff to be available to enhance and expand archives publications and public outreach opportunities. The archives continues to be in the mainstream media because of our efforts to get out more information. We continue to be asked to participate in radio and television shows, with the latest being the British Broadcasting Corporation, or the BBC, who asked for territorial government records of Lucinda Brown for a documentary called The Land of the Free that will air on the History Channel. I think it's later this year it's scheduled to air. They found out about this individual from our Early Oregonians database, which is not only on our website, but is also part of Ancestry.com, who purchased it from us in 2015. We are continually looking to find more efficient ways to do our jobs, and most of that includes using technology. As stated earlier, the Oregon Administrative Rules Database is one of those efficiencies that not only affects our agency, but other agencies as well, and allows access to administrative rules and rulemaking actions.
You can interrupt you real quick, yeah, Mr. Co-Chair.
You said that Ancestry.com, they purchased some data.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? I mean, what type of data, and how does that work?
Co-Chair Manning, we created a database of anybody who lived in Oregon up through 1860, as that was part of our sesquicentennial effort to celebrate Oregon's birthday. It is a database that mostly our volunteers put together along with some of our staff, entering the names and where those records reside with those folks and verifying the information. Ancestry saw the database and asked us if they could buy the information and format from us because it was invaluable to them as far as their genealogical efforts are concerned. So we consulted with the Attorney General, we consulted with the Secretary of State, and found that, yeah, we could sell it to them. We could only recoup the cost of providing the information to them, but we did so. This is not the first time Ancestry has used our database to do a production. They found out that Kelsey Grammer had relatives in Oregon through our database, and so they actually filmed an episode of Who Do You Think You Are at the State Archives in, I think it was late 2014.
Okay, that's interesting. I appreciate that. The only thing that it kind of perks my ears up is that when public funds or public resources are used by private entities who will turn a profit off of that. I always question that. I don't think that that's the way. I think that public money should be done exclusively for public money and not to enrich a private entity so that they can turn a dime off the backs of the Oregonians. So that's thank you for the response.
Co-Chair Marini, they do have to come to us to get the information, though. They just can use the index to locate it, and then they do have to come to us to get the records. So.
Okay. Thank you.
So let me follow up on this really quick. And I am so biased on this because I just have a heart for this work. And I'm looking at the early Oregonian database, and I'm looking at multiple family members I have in here. How do Oregonians go about providing additional information they know they have to feed into this? I mean, let me give you an example. My great-great-great-grandmother, Ann Elizabeth Bills, was the very first registered Republican in Multnomah County. Actually, the last as well. But she sewed the first United States flag for the state of Oregon, was an early pioneer. Her husband's in here. She's in here. Our family is just sitting on boxes of her stuff. How do we protect that?
Co-Chair Smith, give us a call. We'll help you out with that.
But I can go right down the line, and I've got and there's 106,000 potential 103,000 early Oregonians. How do folks such as Senator Johnson or Representative Smith, who have this historical information, how do we feed that in?
Co-Chair Smith, seriously, if you contact us. And what we're always looking to do is update information about where that information is or get more information into the database so it makes it valuable to those who are doing genealogy or who are just doing. We have had people use that database to find individuals that had a particular role in early Oregon government, that sort of thing. And the only way we can get more information is from people contacting us. I know our mandate is only public records, but when it comes to the early Oregonian database, we do add information that is into the database and where it can be accessed through.
I also want to quickly remind folks that while you are the keepers of our written word, the Oregon Historical Society is the keeper of our tangible treasures. And I remember vividly the day that the box containing that flag arrived down here, and at the risk of telling tales out of school on the chair, my recollection is that you had never seen that flag before. You had only heard about it in the lore of your family. And a box about the size of the desk where the witnesses are sitting arrived, packed with all of this archival tissue. And the flag was so gently removed, and I recall a wee tear in the chair's eye looking at this priceless treasure. And so we're so blessed in Oregon to have two repositories with capable professionals taking care of stuff, you with our written word and Carrie Timchuk at the Oregon Historical Society. And that warehouse that they have out in Gresham is like opening up the vault in Indiana Jones. That is the treasure box of our tangible history. It's a pretty big deal. So we're lucky to have those two sources. But as far as the written word,
what I'm trying to get at, Senator, is yeah, you know, for me, my situation's special for my family, et cetera. But there's other folks, not just in Oregon, but around the nation, who have valuable historical data that's sitting in their attic or in their basement. How do we get word out to them?
Co-Chair Smith, that's one of our new, well, we're going to, because, and as I go through my, finish up my presentation here, you'll see, when we used to do 100% of the reference work in the reference room at the State Archives. Today, 99% of that work is being done online. So now my staff has to be refocused away from traditional reference duties, because that's not where the profession's going anymore. So we will have that opportunity to work with folks and have more outreach as to how to protect, preserve, and get it to the proper entities.
Well, I do compliment the good work you folks are doing. Representative Gumberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am cognizant of the time, but we don't usually have this much fun talking about archives.
Right.
So I too am interested in the early Oregon database, and I note on your cover page a reference to the challenges of listing Native American residents of Oregon, but I'm curious about other races or ethnicities within this database.
Co-chairs, Representative Gumberg, we have made a very concerted effort to include everyone who was in Oregon, and the Native American tribes have helped us with the few censuses that they have. The same with the folks who were of Asian descent, African American descent. We work with those communities to try and get those names so that we can get them into our database as well.
A follow-up on that, and this may fall under the purview of the Historical Society, but just listening to you speak, I think it's imperative that we get some of those last Native speakers recorded. The fluent Native speakers for many of the tribes are vanishing, and to have an archive of the spoken word of some of the 9 sovereign nations that are within Oregon would be invaluable.
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, I agree 100%. Maybe Carrie and I can work together on that.
Okay, so colleagues, I've done a horrible job chairing. You still have about 12 slides left and 6 minutes.
I'll speak quickly.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so as I was alluding to earlier, our reference unit fulfills more requests today electronically than ever before, and this does save time and money, but it does mean that we have to access things like electronic drop boxes in order to fill these requests, which raise some security issues. We work closely with our Information Services Division in order to define the best solutions, ensuring security without compromising access and efficiency. However, not all of our technology issues deal with automating and streamlining business processes. As the State Archives, we deal with older technologies that are now woefully out of date, and is left up to us to find ways of keeping this information accessible and migrating it forward. For example, legislative audio tapes that are in no fewer than 5 different formats and require playback equipment that is getting increasingly more difficult to find. We found one on eBay that we had to purchase. The last challenge that I will discuss today is succession planning. 9 of our 22 staff members are eligible for retirement now or in the next 5 years. We've had 2 retirements in 2015 and carefully analyzed those positions before rehiring. One was simply a matter of making the position current to our new standards and focus, while the other position was split apart to create and change positions in records management to allow us to more effectively implement the Oregon Records Management solution. We continue to make it a priority to develop a plan that will help ensure that the State Archives will continue on its innovative path as new staff come on board. And despite all of these things that we're doing and the increased workloads and challenges, we've not had any staff increases and do not anticipate having to add additional staff in the near future. Cost controls, we continue to look ways at being more efficient and to deliver our services in the most cost-effective manner without sacrificing quality. The Oregon Records Management solution is a really good example of that, where we've streamlined our business processes. We've worked with the legislature this past biennium to develop an interface so that the records, the audio, and the other records of this session will automatically export from the legislative system and import into our web portal at the end of session, and what used to take months to complete will now be done overnight. We've completed our phase two of our shelving, added 44% more storage capacity, and saved $125,000 because we only had to buy shelves for the additional space gained. Let's see. In administrative rules, we've created the Oregon Administrative Rules Database, and we're working with legislative counsel to change the statutory requirement of them having to receive paper copies of rules, and that they will receive them automatically from our system as the rules have been changed. If we get to our KPMs, this is our customer service satisfaction, and we have exceeded the 85% goal that is measured. We do receive a lot of feedback on our services. Although they're satisfied what we're doing, they're constantly asking for more information to be put online. For our other KPM, which is the electronic access to public information, when we developed this KPM, I was not sure what to expect. We knew we had to push more information out to the web. We've always been a trendsetter when it came to putting information on the internet, as we became the first archives in the world to enter into the World Wide Web on January 1994, after we successfully petitioned college and university communities to join. In 1993, the last year that the archives did not have a web presence, we fulfilled almost 7,000 requests. The only way that we knew that people knew what we had or how to get it was by word of mouth or knowledge of what an archives did. Fast forward to 2016, where we had 570,000 unique visitors to our web pages, an increase of 255,000 visitors from 2014, and they are accessing and using the information on our website. We had an additional 8,000 visitor requests answered by reference staff, either in person, by phone, mail, or through email. And if I do my math right, that means 99% of our visitors can get their requests fulfilled from the information we have on our website.
Mr. Co-Chair, we can stop whenever you would like, and Mary Beth can be here tomorrow that we can complete this. We have about another 10 minutes or so.
Mr. Co-Chair, would you mind tomorrow if you ran the gavel a little more effectively than I did, and we carry this over to tomorrow and let her finish up tomorrow?
Yeah, not a problem. You did excellent. You always do good.
Well, I'll stay quiet tomorrow. So, Mr. Secretary of State, if that's all right with you.
Thank you, sir.
Colleagues, why don't we do that? That way it keeps us on schedule, gets us out of here on time. All righty. Steve, anything we need to think about?
No, sir.
Okay. Michael, are we good?
Yes, sir.
All right. We are going to adjourn for the day.
Your camera.
Yeah.
Your camera.
Yeah.
We are going to adjourn for the day.